things I had to do. I'm late, and so I apologize for that. So we'd like to have a work session on House Bill 2193 relating to devices regulated by the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Britton, would you...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. House Bill 2193 deals with a number of fees that are in statute today related primarily, well, exclusively to radiological kinds of things, devices, hospital x-ray machines, dental, academic, or veterinary x-ray machines, microwave oven repair facility machines, and the like. We had a public hearing, I believe, back in March on this particular bill. We expect that the revenue raised in this bill will be about $350,000 during the 07-09 biennium. The costs are about $345,000. And this particular piece of the DHS budget is included in a policy option package 105-50. So you've had an opportunity to talk to the agency about that particular POP as well.
Members, I think that one thing we should remember with this bill that we have even a lot of young people, and not that I can identify with this bill since the melon of my skin is different, but at the same time we're having a lot of people and a high number of people in the state of Oregon who are exposed to cancer, with skin cancer, and this bill is coming to us out of the interest of a lot of people who came before one of our other committees, the Senate Committee on Health, and it really is a big problem here in the Pacific Northwest, but we are going to have this pay for itself as to why it's a fee bill, and that's why it's before you today. Are there any comments on this bill, questions?
Good bill, ma'am.
Mr. Wessel?
Looking my way.
I am.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2193 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Westland moves House Bill 2193 to the full committee with a recommendation discussion. And my one discussion is going to be thanks to Representative Morgan for being able to give us a courtesy vote out of committee. And so we want to let you know how much we appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very willing to give this a courtesy vote out of committee, but I would like to have it on the record that these are significant cost increases, and given the amount of general fund that we have available, I think these are rather steep increases. But given the constitutional issue that you have on this side, I very willingly give a courtesy vote out.
Representative Boone had a family emergency with her grandchild, so that's why she's not with us today, so she's excused. Further comments? Senator Boardley.
I would just like to put on record concern about tanning as a health issue, as a health-related concern, something that we should continue to follow up on in our various health policy committees. There are dangers. We need to be aware of those dangers, perhaps even more aware of the dangers, and need to find ways to keep talking about that and consider some regulation, or I'll go so far as to say doing away with the tanning salons. I'm very concerned about the dangers. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Objections? Showing Representative Garrard. 2193 has been adopted. Thank you very much. Thank you again, Representative Morgan, for your courtesy vote. We will now have a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 328 relating to juveniles with mental health disease or defect. I'd like to invite Mr. Taves from the Department of Human Services and Ms. Wendy Johnson from Oregon Law Commission. Catherine, since there's an extra seat, why don't you come up? Ms. White, please.
No. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 328. This bill comes to you out of your Judiciary Committee, and it's a bill that's recommended by the Oregon Law Commission to finish up the recommendations from last session in the area of creating a psychiatric security review board for juveniles. I can go into as much or as little detail as you'd like, but basically what this bill does is add in to present law those juveniles who have the mental disease of mental retardation and want to make a mental disease or defect defense, an insanity defense, as when they're adjudicated. Those juveniles were taken out of the definition last session, those who have mental retardation, and so this bill puts back in the defense for those juveniles. It does a few other things, clarifying the placement authority of the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board and DHS. It also requires rulemaking cooperation between DHS and the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board. And it clearly puts in developmental disabilities treatment providers throughout the bill, because treatment providers are different for juveniles who have developmental disabilities as opposed to other mental health needs. And so, in a nutshell, that's what the bill does. The importance and why the Law Commission took this bill goes back almost, I think, 10 years. All juveniles, just like adults, have the right to an insanity defense. They have that constitutional right. But there was no statutory authority or procedure to make that defense in juvenile court. And so the Law Commission looked at that area of law and determined that Oregon has a psychiatric security review board model that adults use that is known nationally for its success. There are other ways to deal with disposition for a child who commits a crime if they were an adult. There are other dispositional ways to handle that, but the Oregon Law Commission's work group determined that the best model would be to emulate the adult system and create a juvenile panel that's specific to handle these cases who have juvenile expertise. And so that's the bill that passed last session, which was Senate Bill 232. There was a budget note in Senate Bill 232 for the department to come back with a recommendation for what to do with these kids who have mental retardation. The Law Commission also was tracking that and ultimately recommended its own bill that the department ultimately also supported. So with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Norby and Senator Bates.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. How many juveniles with mental retardation are currently housed in a correctional facility rather than a mental health facility?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, I would not have that information. I think I have to defer to the department. But my understanding is the fiscal for this bill is suggesting 10 juveniles who have mental retardation would make the defense in a given year. We had definite opposition from our work group on how that number was calculated and whether that number would be that high, but that's what the fiscal for this bill calculates.
Now, I understand that there are projections. I'm interested in knowing what our current reality is, how many juveniles fit the category as of today.
I'd have to defer to the department on that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, James Tates from the Department of Human Services. And I'll lead off with that. The last time we checked in the Oregon Youth Authority, McLaren, I think there were four or five kids with mental retardation that meet sort of our eligibility criteria, and then a broader group of kids with mild retardation. But of the kids that we know about, since there hasn't been a very good dispositional path until now, we serve currently about 36 children that have committed offenses that potentially could rise to the level of this type of plea, although we all know that most of them or some of them would not. We can't predict the exact number. We know of those 36 kids, I think 22 of those children have committed those types of offenses within the last 18 months. So again, we don't know for a fact how many would actually then use this plea successfully, invoke the plea. But that's the universe of kids that we serve now in pretty secure staff intensive settings in different parts of the state that have committed serious crimes of physical assault, arson, rape, things of that sort.
I'd like to follow up, Madam Chair.
You may.
If you could unpack that number, the 4 and the 22, by race, by gender, ethnicity, that would be very helpful information. Because one of the things we need to be able to track as we are implementing this policy, should we choose to go forward, it's disposition. And given our history of different treatment of juveniles, different treatment of adults in our various systems based on race and sometimes based on sex as well, we need to be able to track this from the very beginning, have a consciousness about it, but then also build in some methods of tracking how we are dispensing justice, if you will.
If you have, Madam Chair, Senator Gorby, we can break that group down very easily and quickly. We'll get that to you right away.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be surprised for what you bring back to us, but would like to know. Thank you.
So, Madam
Representative Garrard, pardon me, Mr. Tate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 6 of the bill says that a juvenile panel will decide what type of dangerous behavior that would require a placement of a youngster into a secure facility. I'm wondering if you could give me some guidelines as to what is dangerous behavior.
Chair Carter, Representative Gord, you're talking about Section 6, Sub 2. The focus there is really on secure facilities, whether a juvenile will be placed in a secure facility or a different type of DHS facility. And that's it's a public safety balance that the department has to make with the board. The board has jurisdiction over the child, but the DHS has placement authority. And so this section is focusing on the department and the board working together to determine what types of behavior warrant a secure, which really translates to a more expensive facility, and what translates to juvenile behavior that's, you know, semi-normal that a facility should be able to take care of. I think really looking, so dangerous would be such that they're going to harm others is the focus. You may.
I'm still trying to think if you answered my question. So the criteria is whether they could harm other people, basically, or themselves.
Chair Carter, Representative Gord, yes, the first section of the bill also talks about that, about what we're looking for is whether they create a substantial danger to others. But obviously, whether they're creating a harm to themselves often will lead to a harm to others as well. So if they're throwing things at others that are, very dangerous, or they're starting fires in a facility, those types of behaviors would be considered likely dangerous. But again, I'm not a mental health treatment provider. I think I'd defer that question to DHS. But the text of it is to focus on that tension between security and in public safety and keeping costs reasonable.
Steve, you have to help out a little bit.
Madam Chair, maybe I can give a broader answer that also more directly responds to your question, Representative. Again, we serve many of these children now, so it's not an issue that we're going to serve a bunch of new kids coming in the pipeline. It's many kids that we serve now, even though there isn't a clear dispositional path if they've committed a major crime against persons like assault, rape, arson, things of that sort. But we get them through deals with the court, through dependency hearings, through all kinds of different vehicles. And currently the department supports these kids in a variety of facilities around the state, in the community, primarily group homes. So many of them are very secure, but they're not locked, and that's an important distinction in this particular bill. But there are doors and windows are alarmed. They're very staff intensive for kids that may have runaway behaviors, and if they run away, may commit another crime. There are some kids that have sight-only supervision when they're in the community. Someone always must be within their sight. So And they're expensive kits. We spend a lot of money securing these kits. The issue for the department, and the department supports Senate Bill 328 and having this dispositional path, the real issue, and Wendy sort of summarized it, it was in the last section where between us and the Psychiatric Security Review Board, we will have to come up with pretty tight criteria on what would trigger a child being in more than a fairly secure place into actually being in a place that's locked. Because unlike the Oregon Youth Authority, the Department of Human Services on the DD side, we don't lock up anybody. We don't have locked facilities. And one of the big issues there, not only is it programmatic and philosophical, but it's a federal fund source, because the federal government will not pay for services to the Medicaid program for DD kids in locked facilities. So that's why we've done many things to do things that are secure but not locked. And the department's issue in this bill from the beginning has been, will we have to end up through this vehicle actually incarcerating some children? And could the costs get away from us if either the courts or the or PSRB begins to say a lot of these kids need to be locked up for public safety reasons? So it's a delicate balance here of sort of balancing the public safety and the needs of the kids and the federal fund sources. And so we've tried to craft language in the last part of this bill that A, says if a child needs to be locked up, A, it can be considered temporary only, first of all, and that we have pretty tight criteria to review that so we don't end up with a growing number of kids in locked settings purely on state general funds, which would become very expensive. And philosophically, it's not where we want to go anyway. So I think it's that delicate balance of we'll continue to serve a lot of these kids in pretty tight treatment secure settings, and then we'll have to create some capacity in those instances where a child is so dangerous that everybody agrees, even with lots of staff supervision and alarms and bells and whistles on where they live, it actually requires something in addition to that to an actual locked facility.
Final comment, Madam Chair. One of the problems that I think we're all concerned about is the fact that once you start moving these youngsters who have a troubled past, they move around the state because that's where a bed may be available to them. And my concern here is about taking a child who may be right on that edge, and you'd have to move them out of the community and they will find a locked facility. I don't think we have any locked facilities other than the jail. So that means moving the youngster out of the community and away from, you know, and so you then get into a whole new myriad of problems in that regard. So I have concern about that portion of the bill.
Senator Borley.
I have a lot of concerns about the PSRB. The more we talk about it, the more we look at how it's going to be implemented, the more nervous I get about what we're taking on here. The rules are yet to be defined by the PSRB. And it's going to be up to the PSRB to determine not only the rules but restrictions and placement that could be should be inclusive of placement in communities. And we know that, you know, there's a lack of so-called front end services, a lack of places in communities where these young people could be placed. So I'm really concerned about that. And then who's going to monitor the relationship that would exist, that will exist between the PSRB and the Department of Human Services, because the Department of Human Services is going to have responsibility for paying for services. It seems to me, Madam Chair and colleagues, that one of the things we've got to look at here is the monitoring of the implementation of this policy. As it rolls out, we need to aggressively monitor how things are being, how this policy is being implemented. We're talking about a juvenile PSRB modeled on the adult program, which has its own issues and concerns. I won't get into that here. But I think we need to look at a budget note, Madam Chair, that would require some regular reporting on progress, a regular reporting on the progress and relationship of the PSRB and DHS as this whole effort is being implemented. But again, I'm really nervous about the services part of it because the community-based placement options don't exist in many communities. So what's the fallback if it isn't lockup someplace?
Chair Anderson, I just would like to respond on the board part of it. This bill, the bill did pass last session that created most of this setup. That board has been meeting monthly since January and is presently working on their administrative rules. The executive director of the PSRB, Mary Claire Buckley, is in Pendleton today doing training, and so she's not able to be here today. But she sends her support of this bill. And you're right that these rules are just being now written. The first clients for the juvenile PSRB won't start until potentially July 1st. And then, you know, that first client will only come if there's a juvenile who's committed a delinquent act and raises the defense. So we are entering into an unknown territory of knowing how many juveniles will make the defense, be successful with the defense, and a court will place them under the jurisdiction of the juvenile PSRB. And there's a lot of steps in there. And so monitoring seems very reasonable and to be expected with a new program like this.
Sandy Gorby, what I'd like to do, since you and Representative Garrard have raised some concerns, what I will do is ask John Britton to work with both of you so we can put a budget note regarding your concerns and the DHS.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I was just going to add the same concern.
Okay.
That I do think that we probably need to have some way of monitoring the steps in the rollout. It is a dramatic change, and I feel a little more comfortable if we did have a bunch of
Let me just note my experience. For 32 years, my singing group used to go out to JDH, and I'll just mention the child's first name was Michelle. You guys remember that? When a baby was thrown into the zoo, and this child had to be incarcerated at JVH in a lockup by herself. And I would think that a PSRB setting would be a little more humane for a kid in that kind of a situation than I would JVH. And again, I don't know. I'm just surmising that I think it's a little more homely, if you will, a homey than a juvenile detention setting would be. So, but I think your concerns are really, really important and register the right kind of caution that we should have, because we can't ever be too cautious when it comes to our children. So that's really, really important. Senator Bates.
The questions are answered. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hotel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on page 3 of the fiscal analysis. Just curious on the paragraph about the children's bond home, where it talks about the waiver we're seeking for federal funds probably won't be granted. Could you give us a little background on that and what waiver we're seeking there for the federal funds and why it won't be granted? Or John,
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, I can't speak to that, but I can let Mr. Daves know what's written in here. There's discussion about in our fiscal impact statement that one of the 10 DD juveniles will be placed at the children's farm home, and the fiscal impact that we got from DHS, I gather, said that this one placement would not be eligible for federal funds match. Department has stated that a federal waiver seeking federal funds for the children's farm home costs is unlikely to be granted. And is that related to the fact that it's more of a secure or locked
system, James?
Madam Chair, Mr. Britton, we can't seek federal funds on the DD side if the child is in an incarcerated setting. Now, in some cases, we may well have kids with dual diagnosis, and they will clearly qualify for the fund source, the federal fund source that we use for the kids with primary mental illness issues at the children's farm home. So I expect some of these kids will have co-occurring conditions that may qualify. And I think we're just trying to say that as we get into this, we have an initial site. We've been working with Kerr Center. We already have a part of their campus that we use. We intend to make that portion of the campus even more secure than it is now, but avoid locking it if we can so we can still use the federal funds. And then if we have one or two kids, perhaps purchase that service from the children's farm home rather than ramping up a whole locked facility that we may not need that then would not allow us to collect federal funds for the other kids that are there. So it's a real delicate balance. We're just conceding that if the child is primarily DD and in a locked facility, we're just not going to collect federal funds. I think we've done all the research in the country, and we've just conceded that. So,
follow up on that?
You may.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the clarification. The sentence right before that talks about the department has stated that facilities, that children's farm home would be the facility where DD juveniles with dual diagnosis would be sent. And you're anticipating only one out of the 10 with a dual diagnosis? That seemed low to me, but I don't know the population, so just wondering. Because if they did have the mental health issue, this is where they probably go, and you could get the match. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that estimate.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotak, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that really would need to be a decision and based on the needs of that child, because in some cases, even though they have significant mental health needs, they'd probably be better served in a DD facility. So, I think it really is sort of a child-by-child decision, because we also access mental health resources in some of our DD facilities where we have kids that have a lot of mental health problems, maybe not the primary diagnosis, but so I'm not sure how I answer that. It really becomes a child-by-child kind of analysis.
That's right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll make my comments very short because Senator Gordley really addressed the issue that I wanted to raise. One, I wanted to say that we do recognize within the DD community, and I'm speaking from an advocacy perspective, that there are people in our community and youth in our community who do pose a serious risk. And we also recognize that the corrections environment is not necessarily the best environment for these children or youth. Because we don't fix people with mental retardation. They will have mental retardation for the rest of their lives. And so we really support the community placements. Our concern, as you know, because of the issues that we have in the DD budget, our concern is just the structural setup that says the PSLB is the entity that is responsible, and at the same time, the impact is through the DD program. And so we feel that in watching the operations and the impacts of PSRB programs, that we feel it's very, very important to urge you to maintain some observation over this process, to look at how this gets implemented. It was a very contentious piece of legislation, and we really urge you to maintain some levels of support and observation over the implementation of this legislation. We do serve these kids in our community right now, and they are in very secure environments. They're there. They're in the community now. This simply moves in the direction of doing more locked facilities. And that's where, as advocates, we come in with some concern about the potential budget impact on the program. And so we strongly support a budget note that would maintain some observation over this program.
Thank you. I've seen it being done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for the whole panel. When one of these children ages out, I think it's age 18 probably, does this panel decide where that individual then goes next? Does the adult PSR board pick him up? What happens when this child becomes 18?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, my understanding is that the aging out won't happen all that often because the longest a person can stay under the PSRB is what the maximum disposition would be. So, you know, it depends on what the crime was that was committed, but they can be transferred to the adult PSRB if the maximum sentence has not been fulfilled yet.
But let me add to that, Madam Chair, Senator Bates. Most of these kids we will continue to serve as they become adults, with or without PSRB jurisdiction. Because if we have vulnerable kids and they've committed crimes and probably don't have a very good or stable home situation to go back to, we fully intend and expect that we'll pick them up in our adult system, again, even if PSRB doesn't have continuing jurisdiction, because we think they'll still need that level of support. So.
Madam Chair, can I follow up on this again?
Please do.
I'm just sensing sort of a crack in the ground here for these people to fall into. If you have someone who has a severe DD problem, has had committed a violent crime, it would seem unlikely, unfortunately, that person will be cured. They're going to have that predisposition the rest of their lives. And if you've got them in a secure facility or a semi-secure facility because of the crime they've committed, the chance of them going back out again, I would expect, and committing another crime seems fairly high. Just because they've aged out or completed a sentence, it still gives me pause about what danger they are to themselves and others. I just don't quite hear how that's going to work. Are they going to be put in outpatient homes? Are they going to be in more secure facilities? It's a case-by-case issue, I suppose.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we serve lots of adults that may have committed crimes or committed acts that were never adjudicated that we also have to secure, either through pretty staff secure or facility design that mitigates against runaway behavior or things of that sort. But there are lots of vulnerable folks that have some pretty dangerous behaviors that we continue to support, not in locked settings, but in our community. And I suppose, knock on wood, we've had very few incidents where they've actually, and we've always, you know, when we talk with communities, you know, compared to people that leave prison and are on parole, I mean, we still maintain 24-hour supervision for these folks and then sort of try to calibrate the level of support based on. The other thing that happens is for kids with mental retardation, I think a lot of the kids, even some who commit real serious crimes, they're not sort of predatory crimes, but more opportunistic or because of poor supervision and supports that they may not have had in their community. And some of these kids with just good supervision and training do get better, and maturation kicks in. And so just because they've even committed a real serious crime does not necessarily mean that they need to be secure forever. Because, again, you have people with a lack of intelligence that can get into dangerous situations, but they're not real predatory. But there are some that are very predatory that really alarm us, that we pay a lot of attention to.
Just to follow up a little, I think my comfort level would be a little better if I knew this crack, as the good Senator Bates identified, would be handled, because I have all the confidence and I know how DHS handles aging out and what happens and that you continue to serve. But I think I'm interested in knowing where that bridge is back. You see the question mark on all of our faces when this question was raised as to what would happen, and perhaps that could be addressed when DHS and the Psychiatric Review Board get together to define the rules in which and how you're going to govern.
And I think that form adds that it's very important that we do have that budget note so that we know what really is occurring. Because that is, you know, as I sit here, and I know that your board, the adult board, operates, you know, with certain different guidelines, and whether those actually meet the needs of this population is an altogether different subject. And so I'm getting a bit uncomfortable in how that's going to really come together and making certain that this population really, whether it's temporary lockup or whether we're back into the community. So, Madam Chair, I would feel comfortable having this added to the amendment.
What we have to do is close the hearing on this bill and open a work session on Senate Bill 328.
Any further comments on this?
Madam Chair. More a question, because this is, we haven't seen too many policy bills. If there's, would it make more sense to amend the bill instead of doing a budget note? I'm just curious if, you know, if you want some feedback mechanism or some stronger language. I'm just curious if that's
right. Well,
if that's
I think that with the Law Commission and the work that they have done with the bill passing the last session, with them being a part of this now, with Catherine, if Catherine and her group can do a Staley lawsuit, they can do any other kind of lawsuit if they feel that we're going in the wrong direction. And we know that they will. All of us know that. And so I'm feeling some comfort in that Mr. Tays has said it's going to be based on a case-by-case analysis as to who goes into this kind of an environment where the boardly budget note and observational analysis that are going on. I think everything is tight and in place, and especially the issue that Representative Garrard raised in terms of kids being carried so far from home because of the lockup situation. I think that with us crafting a budget note, with John working with Garrard and Gordy on this issue, that we're going to put in place some things. And with the Law Commission, they hound dog everybody. You guys know how they are. And I think that will, that we can feel some comfort in knowing that there are sideboards here and there are checks and balances, and if things don't seem to be working out in the way in which they know, the next thing is a lawsuit, and then we got to pay a lot of money for making sure we do it right. So I'm feeling comfortable, Representative Kotek, that the budget note will do and reflect the kind of oversight that we want to have with it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
I'm sorry. Yes, well, excuse me.
Yeah. Should we apologize to Senator Bates?
Shouldn't be a part of the bad boy syndrome. I wouldn't get your names mixed up.
Madam Chair, I will tell you that something that gives me a great deal of
yes,
comfort as well,
okay,
in addition to the proposed budget note, but it's the individual sitting in front of us, Mr. Taves, has done as much or more than any individual I can think of in the state of Oregon to serve a population that is too often overlooked and left behind. And that's what gives me great comfort. So thank you, sir, very much. And with that, Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 328A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion? Senator Wesson moves Senate Bill 328A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? So ordered. Thank you very much. We'd like to open the public hearing and a work session on House Bill 2967. Mr. Britton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a
second, yes, thank you. Figure out what I'm going to say here. Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2967 is to be amended this afternoon with a dash one amendment. I have copies of that amendment that I'd like, Eric, if you could hand out, please. And then I have some remarks to make about this particular amendment, 2967-1. What I'd like to do this afternoon is to review the amendment briefly with you. I'd like to talk about the program cost and the revenue projection associated with this amendment, hand out the fiscal impact statement, and make some closing remarks about this. House Bill 2967, the dash one amendment, is a healthy kids plan. And it is virtually the same as what we saw earlier in House Bill 2201, the engrossed version, with several significant changes. And if you'll follow along with me, we'll talk about those a little bit. If you flip over to the second section of the bill, page 2, talks about down on line 18, the Healthy Kids Fund is established. This is similar to what was in House Bill 2201. Monies from this Healthy Kids Fund are continuously appropriated to the Department of Human Services and the Office of Private Health Partnership. And the percentages mentioned on line 22, on page 2, line 22, refer to a percentage that is initially appropriated to the Healthy Kids Fund, some of which goes to the Oregon Healthy Kids Fund safety net account. And that's mentioned at the top of page 3. This is similar to what was in House Bill 2201B. Likewise, there is a percentage on also the top of page 3, section or subsection C, which transfers money into the Rural Health Care Revolving Account. This is also like House Bill 2201B. Now, one of the first significant changes in this measure is at the bottom of page 2. This program is for children under the age of 19 years of age, but it is also addressing pregnant women eligible for the Oregon Health Plan under Section 3. I'm reading on lines 29 and 30 of page 2. And those women, this is an expansion of women that are currently covered under the Oregon Health Plan from 185% of the federal poverty level, which is the current eligibility, income eligibility standard, up to 250% of the federal poverty line, federal poverty guideline. If you follow with me over on page 3, I'm looking down on line 21. A child under 19 years of age is eligible for enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan or the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program up to an income of 200% of the federal poverty guideline. This is identical to what was in House Bill 2201B. We'll get to the Office of Private Health Partnerships component of this in a second. Notice on lines 25 through 27, pregnant women, a woman is eligible for enrollment up to, if the household income of the woman's family is no more than 250%. This is one of the major changes I mentioned a second ago. I'm flipping on over to page 4 within section 4. Middle of the page, line 17, this is a discussion of the Office of Private Health Partnerships. This is the other or another significant change to House Bill 2201B. This is that a child under 19 years of age whose family's household income is more than 200%, but no more than 250%. In House Bill 2201B, the income level was up to 300%. This takes that part down to 250%. Other than that, those are the major two changes to the program. If you flip over to the very last page, page 14 of this dash one amendment, you'll notice another major change, and that is that this is a referral to voters. Section 34, line 15 on page 14. So, three major changes. This takes women who are eligible under the Oregon Health Plan up from 185% of the federal poverty level to 250, but it takes children eligible for this program down from 300, as was in House Bill 2201B, down to 250%. And finally, this is a referral to the voters.
Discussion?
No, actually, I wasn't. Sorry.
Excuse me.
I have several handouts for you, and I'll hand this one out first.
Eric will help you.
The handout that's being given to you right now is very similar, again, to what I provided for you with House Bill 2201B. Everything on this is practically the same, with a couple of exceptions. On lines 10 and 11 of this display, you notice that there's a savings to the Office of Private Health Partnerships by reducing the federal poverty limit income level from 300% down to 250% for children. That saves an estimated $4.8 million of state funds. Adding pregnant women to go up to 250% of the FPL on line 11 adds a cost of $5.6 million. The net cost increase then is about $800,000 compared to House Bill 2201B. The total state funds cost for the Healthy Kids program is on line 13 over on the far right. It's $60.4 million of state funds. I've added a column labeled 2009-11. It's about $150 million in 2009-11. Other components in the second box on this page of House Bill 2967-1. This is not dissimilar to what was in 2201. The numbers have changed just a little bit, but it provides safety net grants of about $5.6 million on line 14. It provides payments to the tobacco use reduction account of $7.1 during the 2007-09 biennium. That goes up considerably to $22.8 in this measure for the 09-11 biennium. And finally, on line 16, rural health clinics get about $2.1 million from this measure. Toward the bottom, I have added Healthy Kids revenue beginning balance is zero for 2007-09. The revenue estimate, and I'll give you that in a moment, for these costs, associated with these costs, is about $148 million of new tobacco tax money. The program cost, $75.2 million, is the $60.4 on line 13 added to $14.8 on line 17. So we have an ending balance at the end of 07-09, a projected ending balance of about $72.8 million. In the 09-11 biennium, you see that ending balance is carried forward
The revenue projection for these costs is about $232.1 million. Program cost, $184.7, which again is line 17 and line 13 for 09-11.
Discussion?
I have questions, but I'd like to hold them until Mr. Britton is finished, if that's okay with the chair.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I have about two more things.
I'm much too anxious. I'll wait. Thank you.
This next chart that I have just handed out was produced by the Legislative Revenue Office, and it shows the revenue projections for the Healthy Kids plan and how those funds would be distributed given this particular bill, 2967-1. The 07-09 biennial projection, the total net cigarette tax and other tobacco tax would be $152.8 million. 09-11 is $233.2 million. There are some hold harmless revenues going to the state general fund. That's the very first line, as well as the Oregon Health Plan. And three lines towards the bottom, local government cities, counties, and transit. Those are funds that would replace revenue that is currently collected but would be reduced through the increase in the tax.
May I ask a clarifying question on this?
Sure.
Mr. Britton, I'm not clear why in the 09-11 biennium, the funding that is going into all of these accounts, with the exception of TURA and rural health, well, basically, why the money to the local governments and the state general fund and the health plan go down?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I'm not sure of that. I would have to ask the Legislative Revenue Office that question. Other than it is a byproduct of the revenue projections given the distribution in this particular amendment.
But my understanding is that the local revenue sharing aspect to this is a percentage of the total. And so it was curious to me that it falls off significantly.
Yes, and I'll have to defer that to the Legislative Revenue Office.
Thank you.
Hopefully I'll come back before we finish this piece.
Madam Chair, I'll follow up that question if I could.
Can you allow us
it might be the answer.
This question? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yes.
It appears, Mr. Putin, that while each of these programs has a diminishing amount allocated to them as the revenue goes down, that the Oregon Health Plan does not have it. It goes from $213 million to $222 million. Is that a policy decision? You know, 09-10 and then 210-211?
Couldn't hear the question.
I'm sorry.
It appears, I think the question that Representative Morgan is asking is why do the city and county seem to have a diminishing amount, greater proportion than you'd expect to the others? As I look across these columns, if I'm reading them correctly, TURA is held harmless. Our health plan appears to actually go up despite a decreasing revenue in 09 and 010 to 210 to 11. And that would account for my mind that if you had a set amount of money available to you, that's why local, county, and city government is getting less money. Is it a policy decision in the bill to maintain a higher level for the Oregon Health Plan in order to keep? What I'm guessing is you made a decision to keep a certain percentage of the population insured, pregnant women and children, and that will take on more money proportionally than what's left over for the rest of it. That's all I'm saying.
We've called the experts here too, so we're in good hands with you.
The question from Senator Representative Morgan is that why do you see diminishing dollars in greater proportion to cities and counties than you do to the state? Is that right?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, the way we have handled the amounts of revenue, of course, as you know...
For the record.
For the record, Madam Chair, Mazelman, if I just think of our office.
Thank you, Mazelman.
Whenever, of course, you tax something, what you do is the consumption becomes less. So what we have done is allocated certain amounts of the new revenue to the old uses, which is primarily cities, counties, and transit for the disabled and elderly. By doing this, and also to maintain the new policy direction, if you will, of increasing money for TURA and tobacco reduction, as well as something that we had to change the formulas within the statutes. So the formulas that distribute tobacco taxes in the statutes come in two pieces, basically. It treats tobacco taxes, which is $1.18, in a piece of 60 cents and a piece of 58 cents. And each of these two pieces have a different distribution because they're trying to maintain the intent that the voters have passed when those increases were instituted. However, during the time, every time you change, we need to adjust for hold harmless. So we had to change those percentages a little bit, and accordingly, tumbling down through the time, that's what the effect of what it happened. What we wanted to go to is primarily to get to a zero impact in about three bienniums. So whatever happens, we could not get to a zero impact immediately because of all the fluidity, if you will. Because TURA today receives money, for example. It's going to receive a lot more money later. Health plan receives money, but it's not supposed to receive any more money under the new plan. So that's the balance that we had to do. Who receives some from the new money and who continues receiving only from the old money?
House.
And under Measure 44, the 60 cents but 97% of that money, or most of it, for the Oregon Health Plan. And none of the new money is going to the Oregon Health Plan. So how do you maintain what goes to the Oregon Health Plan while everybody else is also need to be maintained on some, increased on some not? That's what the impact of the
changes. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Morgan.
So what happens to the cities and the counties when you look out into 11-13? Is it the same as the 09-11 numbers?
So it would be slightly less, Representative Morgan, slightly less. However, that amount, if you look at the total, what they lost and what they're getting, it would be closer to revenue neutral. So they're not losing any money of what they are getting today, nor they're gaining except those few amounts of dollars at the beginning.
I'd like to follow up on the impact on local governments. I've seen something similar in other areas of budgeting where it, even though an explanation might be, well, the number of dollars they're getting is the same or a little bit more, it sure looks like we're going back on our word for what percentage of the share they thought they could count on when there's been a formula that's been in place for a certain amount of time and the local governments are used to planning on that share as a proportion, a percentage. Costs go up for cities and counties just like costs go up for the state. So to me, getting the same dollars is also saying we're forcing you to slide back. It's as if we've set up a contingency fund. The contingency fund is called cities and counties, and we just take away from the share that we had agreed to some years ago and say, well, we needed some money, so we're taking it away from you
to move it around to somewhere else. The reason I'm especially concerned about this way of dealing with the formula problem right now is looking at the potential for an imminent crisis with the loss of federal funds to counties. And so when we're talking about counties may have to shut down public health programs or may have to stop delivering certain kinds of human service programs or community corrections, at the same time we're talking about that in other parts of the building or other parts of the budget, that's who we're looking to first to try to fix some funding problem we have. To me, it seems like these two ways of dealing with it are contradictory. And at this time, I was just surprised to see this. What this says to me is that it's been important to redouble our efforts to have a continuing discussion, perhaps in the interim after this session is over, about looking at a different way of how we partner with counties and cities. We can't solve all the problems of the loss of federal funds right now, but I think we must talk about it in a more systematic way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that I agree that this is a larger interim discussion, but in the meantime, the adjustments here are to hold harmless the different funding streams. And so this isn't the total amount that these individual line items are receiving. It's just making up the gap to make sure that we are holding them harmless as we institute an additional tax. So I want to thank Mazen for all his work in crunching the numbers.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, Representative Corker, although what you have described on the percentages and the money and hold harmless is true in many cases in the cigarette tax universe, it is not. And the reason for that, because there has always been a specification of number of pennies rather than percentages. So the tax, for example, that was allocated for cities, counties, and cities was pennies per peck. So, and actually, if you would have kept it pennies per peck, they would have lost money rather than gained or maintained percentages. So what we have done was the contrary. Is trying to push the percentage up, so it became more pennies per peg for them rather than less to maintain the amounts of revenue that they're getting. Otherwise, they would have lost if we have maintained that pennies per peg that was. Remember, this is most of it was voter initiative in addition to legislative action. And, you know, I've never seen the legislature make two contradictory policies in the same session in my life.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wesley. Okay, I've got it. I made up with it today. Senator Wesley.
Are you ready for a motion, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair. One more piece of paper, and that is the fiscal impact statement for this bill. And I want to point something out to you. This is what we have typically done for referrals in our fiscal impact statements, is to talk about the cost of the referral, and that is what this fiscal impact statement does. It does not talk about program costs, those that we just discussed. It talks about the cost of a referral, which is estimated at between $1.6 and $1.8 million general fund. Now, if there are other things to refer to a election or special election, that would obviously reduce the cost for this particular, depending on how many other things are referred. Last point I want to make is that the way this referral works is that there is the need for another bill that addresses the ballot title for this referral.
I have one more question, but I would defer with your consent until Mr. Britton is finished.
Thank you.
the need for another bill that addresses the ballot title for this referral, the date of the election, an explanatory statement, and the fiscal impact statement. So the fiscal impact statement would actually be inserted into that other bill.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Mr. Britton, with reference to the spreadsheet that you handed us out first, can you look into the 11-13 biennium and give us what the projected ending balance is?
I can't, Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, because I don't know what the revenue is for that particular biennium.
And why is the revenue not known?
Because I haven't received it from the Legislative Revenue Office. We typically do two bienniums out, so we're doing 07-09 and 09-11.
So, but in theory, then, you have a program that has a potential for a double-digit increase in cost. A health care program, you could potentially consider it to have about a 20% increase in cost. The revenue, I would assume, if the TRUR piece of this is working, would, best case, be stable. But if we're successful, it would be down. So, based on that, would it be fair to say that we would have this amount left at the end of the 11-13 biennium?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I don't know, because, again, I don't have a revenue projection. If revenue is flat and costs go up 20%, the ending balance will not be $120 million. It'll probably be something less.
Thank you. Further discussion?
I know the time is short, but I want to ask a question to Mr. Britton. You may not be able to answer this. If you can't, I understand. We have a tendency to look at health care in chunks and pieces. So you look at a program like this, and you say, okay, this is the revenue, this is the cost. Revenue outpaces cost somewhere down the line if we don't change how we deliver health care. The question I have is, you're talking about expanding here pregnant women for prenatal care. You're talking about expanding into a population that's going to be, if not treated, in our hospitals anyway. We're talking about kids and women who are going to be treated one way or the other. But the cost savings by bringing them in for preventative care are not calculated in this bill to the entire system, entire healthcare system. And I would guess, and cannot prove, and maybe you can't prove right now, but I'd like to look at this because there's ways of calculating it. By putting this kind of a program in place, the state revenues may level out or drop and not support the program completely. But the overall picture of healthcare, it dramatically decreases the cost of healthcare, dramatically decreases healthcare by getting everybody insured, by preventing premature deliveries, by keeping kids out of hospitals and emergency rooms and admissions to hospitals for asthma, bronchitis, and pneumonia because we're getting treated in the primary care setting. That's the part of this that we never see or talk about. And that's the part we should be talking about. Do you have any way of getting those numbers for us? We have 1 minute.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, I don't have any way to get those numbers. That's some fairly sophisticated analysis that's probably beyond me. But these are the costs that we anticipate for the Oregon Health Plan, money that we have to come up with
today.
But it does not take into account any cost savings throughout the system. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I am ready for a motion.
Okay.
Yeah. I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2967.
Senator Westland moves Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2967. Objections?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2967 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Westland moves House Bill 2967 to the full committee with a full with a due pass recommendation. Are there objections? Representative Morgan, Representative Garrard, and Senator Winters. No further objections?
Are you taking any comments, Madam Chair?
You certainly may.
Thank you. I really appreciate you indulging me here. I appreciate this is kind of a feeling of deja vu all over again, that I still have the same concerns about this incarnation of the bill as I did before. It appears to me that the substantive change here is the addition of pregnant women and buying that by increasing the poverty level of children. And that is, that's just a kind of a structural change in the program. But I still have great concerns over the cost increase in this policy area that we can, it's a given that we're going to see significant roll-up costs here. We're going to fund it with a decreasing revenue source, and we're going to be putting a lot of children and pregnant women out there expecting to be covered by providers that don't exist, especially in the rural parts of the state. So basically the same concerns that I had the first time around, and respectfully, Madam Chair, I will be a no vote on this.
Thank you very much. Further discussion?
Madam Chair, I share the same concerns, and I share the concern that we're using a declining revenue source for a program. That was a concern I had early on. In addition, I think that although I support kids, I also felt we needed to this session look at ways that we were going to support kids and families, because it's recognized that if we don't have the parents, we don't get the kids. And I know that there's another piece of legislation out there. It seems like this session we've had several that I want to take and have the opportunity to look at the other piece, because this does not address what I consider that we need healthy families in the state of Oregon as well as healthy kids.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
I just can't let this go unchallenged, so we'll continue our argument back and forth here. These people are going to get treatment, whether in this plan or whether they're uninsured. We can choose to bring them in here and get better treatment for them with good preventative care and cool down those costs to our entire system, or we can choose to leave them out of the system where they'll generate even higher costs, which will be cautioned back to all of us. It's short-sighted thinking to think that by refusing this program, you're going to save money and roll-up costs. We have to think about more than just our state budget here. We got to think about the cost of health care in the state of Oregon. And leaving these people out of this program, or thinking we'll leave them out of the program, only rolls up a higher cost for the entire state. These people will get treated. These babies will be born. Some of them will be born prematurely at a cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars, which could be prevented if they had good primary preventative care, good prenatal care. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree with Representative Morgan that the rural health care amount is inadequate. There needs to be more money put into the rural health part. If we can't do it now, we have to do it later, but I think that's an excellent point.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Representative Kotek and Representative Nathanson.
Madam Chair, I just want to say thank you for moving this bill today. I think I'm thrilled to see it back. I think this is a sound plan. It's a sustainable plan. We have the numbers out in 2011-13 that we had from the previous bill. I assume we'll be very close to what we see for this bill. I would disagree with my colleagues who worry about where we're going to be with this. If we don't do this, we're losing an opportunity to invest and make wise choices, and this is really going to change the face of the health of our kids in the state if we do this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to make a brief statement also. I think this is a very important bill to send forward today. Within a short period of time, 2 years, 4 years, and 6 years out, we're going to start seeing healthier children who grow into healthier adults. We're working on not only the cost of health care to the state, but on having healthier people, and that's what this bill can start doing.
Thank all of you who registered your concern. Let the record show that Representative Garrard, Representative Morgan, and Senator Winters are no votes. Thank you very, very much for your hard work. House Bill 2967 is adopted. Representative Nathanson will carry it in full, and Representative Kotek will carry it on the floor. Good luck, ladies. Have a great day.